capital, Mogadishu. According to AP, at least 78 people were killed when a huge vehicle bomb exploded at a busy intersection. AP correspondent Zaria Shackley has a report.
It was one of the deadliest attacks in Mogadishu in recent memory. The toll was likely to rise as scores of people were rushed to hospitals. University students were among those killed. Police said the dead also included two Turkish nationals. Officials said the blast targeted a tax collection center during the morning rush hour as Somalia returned to work after its weekend. Images from the scene showed the mangled frames of vehicles and bodies lying on the ground. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the blast. The Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab often carries out such attacks. I'm Zaria Shakili.
A Taliban force today raided an army base in southern Afghanistan, killing at least 10 soldiers. The Afghan military says the pre-dawn bomb and gunfire attack happened in mainly Taliban-controlled Helmand province. An insurgent spokesman claimed Taliban fighters overran the army post and killed 26 Afghans. The insurgents this week have carried out repeated attacks against government forces in different provinces. As usual, a major New Year's Eve focus in the U.S. will be on Times Square, New York City. Police say there are no credible terror threats, but that they are taking no chances. Here's AP's Julie Walker.
Thousands of police officers, 175 blocker vehicles, heavy weapons teams, bomb-sniffing dogs, radiation detectors, drones, helicopters, and even boats. NYPD Chief of Intelligence and Counterterrorism, John Miller.
Times Square is probably going to be the safest place on the planet Earth on New Year's Eve, because nobody else puts that kind of effort into an event like this.
Police Commissioner Dermot Shea.
We currently have no specific credible threats directed toward any of our events. Still, I'm going to ask that members of the public, as always, remain vigilant.
Julie Walker, New York.
From Washington, this is VOA News. Kazakhstan is observing a national day of mourning, a day after 12 people died when a passenger jet crashed shortly after takeoff from Almaty Airport. The plane, carrying nearly 100 passengers, was operated by budget carrier Beck Air and was torn apart when it slammed into a building. In the capital, Nur-Sultan, Kazakhstan's largest flag was at half-staff, while officials made urgent appeals for blood donations to help injured survivors. An investigation of the tragedy is underway, and for now, all Beck Air flights have been suspended. 2019 has seen a record number of mass killings in the U.S., and 33 of those 41 deaths resulted from shootings. Here's AP correspondent Shelley Adler with a report.
I will come to you in the silence.
One of the many tragedies took place in Virginia Beach, where 12 people were killed in a workplace shooting. Bobby Dyer is the mayor there.
This is a nightmare that nobody ever wants to live.
22 people lost their lives in August at a Walmart in El Paso. Governor Greg Abbott spoke at a memorial service.
We know this evil will not overcome us.
Very shortly after that, there was shock in Dayton, where 9 people were gunned down, which led frustrated protesters to tell politicians,
do something! Do something! Do something! Do
I'm Shelley Adler.
In Hong Kong today, police fought with protesters who marched through a shopping mall demanding that mainland Chinese traders leave the city in another weekend of anti-government tension in the Chinese semi-autonomous territory. The demonstration in Sheung Shui, near Hong Kong's boundary with the mainland, was part of efforts to pressure the city's government by disrupting economic activity. Police in civilian clothes with clubs tackled and handcuffed some protesters. Government broadcaster RTHK reported 14 people were detained. Russia's defense ministry says it has deployed its first intercontinental hypersonic nuclear-capable missiles. President Vladimir Putin has boasted the weapon, which can travel 27 times the speed of sound, puts Moscow in a weapons class of its own. The United States says it will not characterize the Russian claims. Thousands of koalas are feared to have died in a wildfire-ravaged area north of Sydney, Australia, further diminishing the country's iconic marsupial. While the fire danger accelerated Saturday in the country's east as temperatures soared. The mid-north coast of New South Wales was home to as many as 28,000 koalas, but wildfires in the area in recent months have greatly reduced their population and their habitat. More news at voanews.com. Gene Randall, VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Officers have been stopped from traveling and so forth. So money is being saved as well in those areas. And this is just one of the actions by the president to show that he should lead the way as government officer number one to the people.
Zambian President Edgar Lungu cut his wages as energy prices rise.
The most important is the willingness of both sides to cooperate and to partner. What is the good news on the Angola-United States relations is that there is an increase in confidence from U.S. operators in Angola.
Angola seeks to share its conflict resolution experience with parts of Africa that are grappling with conflicts.
People have faced a lot of atrocities from the previous governments. That's why we determined to bring justice for the people of Darfur and the people of Sudan through different ways.
And Sudanese Opposition Justice and Equality Movement, or JEM, welcomes government inquiry into crimes against humanity in Darfur. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. By Zambian President Edgar Lungu to slash his salary and that of senior government officials is a goodwill gesture in the face of fuel and electricity hikes, according to presidential spokesperson Isaac Chipampe. He says the salary cut ranges from 15 to 20%. The president's action, Chipampe says, is aimed to soften the impact the hikes would have on the less privileged Zambians. But critics say the fuel and electricity hikes are strong indications that the government has failed to effectively administer the country's affairs. To learn more about the president's rationale behind the salary slash, I reach presidential spokesperson Isaac Chipampe.
The fuel hike, which has just been announced by the oil regulation company. And then apart from that, there was also an announcement that next month, which is next week, there will be a hike in electricity tariffs. So the president is just making a goodwill action to cushion the impact that these two decisions by the regulating authorities has made. So he has also directed that even the other presidential appointees, like cabinet ministers and permanent secretaries and the directors and ministries, should have their salaries cut between 10 and 20%. So it's just a decision that he feels that might mitigate the impact on the vulnerable groups in society, especially that electricity and fuel prices have gone up.
So, Isaac, what impact does the president seek this cut in salaries of his and that of his cabinet senior ministers would have on the population, and what will the monies be used for specifically?
The government is assessing is quantifying how much will be saved, because it also includes prestatio companies, you know, state firm, state company, and the chief executive. So the amount to add them up are quite massive, and it's hoped that this money will go to. We have things like social cash transfer. This is money which is collected and it goes to the vulnerable groups. The president is hoping that this money will be channeled into the social cash transfer, and part of it will go into cushioning the impact, especially in the energy sector, electricity and their fuel.
Well, Isaac, some Zambians have said there is a challenging prevailing economic conditions. So my question is, were these hikes in fuel and electricity unavoidable or inevitable for them to be raised?
Well, one would say that you could avoid them for now, but the impact it will have in future is great. Because, for example, government has been subsidizing the cost of electricity. The cost of electricity in Zambia is not cost-reflective. The investment that the power utility puts in compared to how much units families pay and the company is not commensurate. So the utility company has been making losses. So now we are trying to save this company so that it continues generating power. As long as we keep on suppressing the real tariffs, the real prices for electricity. In fact, that money is supposed to go to other sectors, social sectors, like health. But this is money which always goes into the energy sector, subsidizing. So the president is simply saying, instead of playing politics, let's be real. Let's let people pay cost-reflective tariffs if we have to enjoy our electricity. So what has happened is that slowly the government is removing the subsidies and taking that money to other sectors like health, like education, and so forth. But obviously the impact is too much on the people, and that's why the president is taking actions like cutting salaries and so forth to cushion that impact.
Well, Isaac, what is the message here? Because a lot of these opponents of the government and critics of the government are saying this is just a mere publicity stunt and will not be able to help the ordinary Zambian because of the hikes. So what is your reaction to these criticisms from the opposition?
Well, the reality is that the money will be able to help. It's not the only action that government has made. For example, senior government officials have been placed under austerity measures, meaning the traveling has been cut, officers have been stopped from traveling and so forth. So money is being saved as well in those areas. And this is just one of the actions by the president to show that he should lead the way as government officer number one to the people.
Isaac Chipampe is the spokesperson for Zambian President Edgar Lungu. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Angolan Foreign Minister Manuel Domingos Augusto says his government is working with regional bodies and international partners to resolve conflict in South Sudan and Central African Republic, or CAR. Angola is also helping to resolve tensions between Uganda and Rwanda. In a sit-down interview, the Angolan foreign minister told me, as head of the African Union's Peace and Security Group, his country seeks to share its conflict resolution experience with parts of Africa that are grappling with conflict in an effort to ensure peace and stability.
With the Angola's role in the African Union's security organ, what proposals will the Angolan government support in resolving some of these challenges, particularly in South Sudan and the DRC and the Central Africa region?
In its capacity as a chair for the month of December of Peace and Security Council of African Union, we organized a meeting of a ministerial meeting of Peace and Security Council in Luanda last week, as well as a meeting of United Nations Security Committee for Peace in Central Africa. During these two meetings, with several ministers from various countries of Africa, we review the situation. Angola is trying to play its role as one of the most stable countries in the region. Angola thinks that it can share its own experience on conflict resolution and prevention with the other sister countries.
Between the U.S. and Angola. Looking at the partnership, some people have suggested that the Angolan government should partner the U.S. in order to repatriate stolen funds from Angola, from the U.S. to Angola to boost Angola's economy. What is your stance on it, and what is the progress report that you can talk about?
The United States made itself available to help Angola on this endeavor of retrieving some of the assets. And I will not elaborate much because this is a work going on between the relevant entities, namely our Attorney General Office and the Minister of Justice and the Attorney General, as well as some of the federal agencies in the United States. So far, I think that we are happy with the spirit of cooperation shown you know, this kind of thing, they take time. And you must be patient. The most important is the willingness of both sides to cooperate and to partner. What is the good news on the Angola-United States relations is that there is an increase in confidence from U.S. operators in Angola. Just 2 days ago, or 3 days ago, Chevron announced a big investment in Angola of almost $2 billion. So we're happy with this because we can see that in 2 years, with President Lourenço in power, we are regaining confidence of the potential investment partner. And that's the best. So that's why President Lourenço is very much engaged and focused on his fight against corruption in order to end impunity, in order to set a really new business environment, a friendly environment for partners, for investors, and also working on the changing of the mindset of the population.
Briefly, how would you rate the president's fight against corruption and impunity in Angola?
They are bearing fruit. It's bearing fruit. We have many cases now in the courts being tried. But more than this case, we can feel that there is a changing in the people's behavior. And not only by fear, but by conviction that that's the only way our country can be normal. So takes time. We are only 2 years on this fight, but the results so far are very encouraging.
Manuel Domingos Augusto is the Angolan foreign minister. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Political activists in the Southern African Kingdom of Eswatini plan to unite and launch a series of nationwide strikes to demand for more democratic reforms, according to the leader of the Political Parties Assembly, or PPA, Infandlana Shongwe. He said members of the group will not be deterred in their determination to seek democratic reforms early next year. Citing an investigation into issues of national security, the police detained and questioned political activists, trade union officials, and civil society leaders in the Southern African Kingdom. However, critics say the move was aimed to intimidate, harass, and thwart demands for democratic reforms. For more about the plans of the activists, I reach Infandlana Shongwe.
It has been resolved that early this year, all these political formations and civic groups should come together. But when they come together, what we are calling to say, look, we are ready to talk to whosoever is there. We are ready to negotiate. We are ready to say, let us sit down. We are a small country, less than 1 million active people, but we can't sit down around the table. We've been going around the world telling people that we believe in peaceful negotiations, but that is very, very, very difficult to in Swaziland. So these are some of the things that we will be pushing.
Well, the discussion also focus or consider negotiating with the monarchy, because the monarchy holds power in the kingdom. And for that matter, the king is not subject to the constitution. So will you consider negotiating with the king, or for that matter, the monarchy as well?
The monarchy is in the center of the whole problem here, because he is above the constitution, whereas under normal circumstances in any democracy, no one should be above the constitution. Everybody should be subjected to the constitution. For instance, here is a situation where they go to court, get permission to search us. And those courts are part of the bigger network of suppressing and oppressing the people, because there is no rule of law. When you talk, there is no separation between judiciary, between legislature and the rest. So this is one. And the king, by the way, holds all these powers. So now, We cannot go via through the constitutional means, but instead we are there is no any other alternative here but to face it. Well, how do we do it? We do it peacefully on the streets, and our call is: if they don't believe that the people want change, at least what about the referendum? If we can't go to negotiations right away and negotiate about what? Negotiating about having the monarchy staying out of politics, because the real problem here is to have the monarchy mainly on political issues. By the way, political issues need checks and balances. If you are going to have a situation where you do not have checks and balances, you are going to have a situation where at one point the whole populace will be subjected under poverty as it is.
Does that also mean that the mass action you're talking about will be protests or demonstrations peacefully? And what happens if you undertake this, which could be clamped down by the state security operatives?
Look, the last march we had, which was a result of the recent clampdown, which was a recent raid, it was the first of its kind, by the way. The first of its kind to be apolitical, a rally, openly calling for change. Now, we have reached a threshold where we can neither go back or surrender, but what is left for us is to die. We undertake this action knowing very well the dangers, the risk involved.
But the king, as you are aware, says the people of Eswatini practice monarchical democracy, and that there's democracy, there's an election, although political parties, although can operate, are barred from participating in the elections. Isn't this enough? Compromise.
There is no monarchical democracy. There is only one democracy, that is the rule of law by the majority. So you can't have something like monarchical democracy. You cannot reinvent the wheel. Democracy is flourishing in some parts of the world. It is not at its infancy. Now, monarchical democracy, which runs election through a one-party system, because what we are talking about here is monarchical democracy is an interpretation of a one-party system, which in its election, there is no opposition. All those people that end up in parliament, they are not standing for anybody. In fact, if you were to go to their constituencies that elected them into power right now, you will be shocked that none of them still wants those people to be there.
Ifadlala Shogwe is the leader of the Political Parties Assembly, PPA, of Swaziland. He spoke with me from Bazidi. The Sudanese opposition group Justice and Equality Movement, or JEM, has welcomed as a positive step a government inquiry into alleged crimes committed in the Darfur region under former President Omar Hassan al-Bashir. The Hague-based International Criminal Court, or ICC, issued arrest warrants against Bashir due to the atrocities committed in the Darfur region. The ICC charged the former president with genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, charges the former president denies. For reaction to the investigation launched by the current Sudanese transitional government, I reached Motasim Adam, spokesperson for the Sudanese Justice and Equality Movement, or JEM.
It is very good news for us and for all freedom fighters and human rights defenders, and it is very, very good news for the internally displaced persons and for the refugees and the people of Darfur in general and all Sudanese people. The atrocities that took place in Darfur, which include but not limited to crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide, that include also rape for young girls and women and elderly, and burning villages and all this kind of brutality. I think by initiating official investigation, the people of Darfur will be happy, the freedom fighters and human rights defenders as well. And we hope that this investigation should be transparent and should be extended to all levels of the government, the former governments, and shouldn't exclude any general, including those who are in power currently. Have you been invited by the government to participate since your party has been championing the cause for an investigation of such proportion for what you described as atrocities committed against your people by the former administration?
We were not being invited officially by the government, but we think this step is very important step. And we encourage such kind of steps, and we would like the government to launch a wide investigation for all type of atrocities and crimes that been committed by the former regime of al-Bashir. For us, peace is very important, but the most element of peace is justice and security. And by initiating such investigation, we think the government is in right track. And I think this also will reform the relation between the people of Darfur and the transitional government, because you may hear that all the delegation that visited Darfur were asked this question, where is peace? So peace is very important for the people of Darfur. And you cannot talk about peace unless you bring justice to the table, and justice is one step before peace.
Well, since your movement basically seeks to defend the people of Darfur, what interaction are you having with them about their response to the investigation being carried out by the transitional government about the atrocities committed against them?
As you know, that there's a big gap between the people of Darfur and the transitional government, because the transitional government is backed by freedom and change forces. And there's distrust between the freedom and change forces and the people of Darfur. The people demonstrated against them many times, especially when they visited Darfur. And also, the people of Darfur think that freedom and change forces are not ready for peace, and peace is not one of their priorities. Therefore, I don't think people will interact that much with this news. However, the idea of initiating investigation against the crimes and atrocities taken place in Darfur is a good sign, and people will appreciate it, not only in Sudan, but all over the world.
So what is GEM going to do about this investigation launched by the government regarding the atrocities committed against the people of Darfur that you defend, your group say?
Justice is very important issue for justice and equality movement. And as you see, part of our name is justice. That's why we deeply concerned about justice, and part of our negotiations currently with the government of Sudan in Juba is justice. We determined to bring justice for the people of Darfur and the entire people of Sudan. We will fully cooperate with the transitional government in its investigations, and we are ready to provide evidence of the atrocities and crimes that the former government of al-Bashir committed in Darfur, and we are ready for any invitation from the transitional government to work together to bring justice for the people of Darfur. As you know, the internal displaced persons, the IDPs, and the refugees in Eastern Chad, and all people in Sudan, and not only in Darfur, in Kordofan, in the east, in north, in Khartoum, and in everywhere in Sudan, people have faced a lot of atrocities from the previous governments. That's why we determined to bring justice for the people of Darfur and the people of Sudan through different ways. Part of it is the negotiations. We think that the International Criminal Court also one of our tools, and also local investigations that reach to all criminals that killed the innocent people of Darfur, raped the women, burned villages, and so forth.
Mutasim Adam is the spokesperson for the Sudanese Justice and Equality Movement, GEM. He spoke with me from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
and you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Guillaume Soro, a former rebel leader in Ivory Coast and a candidate in next year's presidential election, could face life in prison over an alleged coup plot that involved amassing weapons, the country's public prosecutor said Thursday. The Ivorian authorities issued an arrest warrant for Soro on Monday, prompting him to call off a planned homecoming after months overseas. The warrant is likely to increase tensions ahead of an October 2020 election that is seen as a test of Ivory Coast stability after two civil wars since the turn of the century. For analysis on the latest development of the situation in Ivory Coast, Nyaka Lagoke, a political analyst, joins me live in the studio here in Washington, D.C. Hello, Nyaka, and welcome to Nightline Africa.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
So let me ask you, what was your reaction or what did you make of the arrest warrant issued by the government or by the public prosecutor against Guillaume Soro, a former speaker of the National Assembly of Parliament of Ivory Coast?
It's just the result of the war between Alassane Dramane Ouattara and Soro Guillaume. And as we know, Soro Guillaume was the leader of the rebellion that they launched on behalf of Mr. Ouattara for him to become to run for president. And then, so there was a civil war, as you said. Soro thought that he was going to become the successor of Mr. Ouattara, who had other plans. We thought it was going to be for the Prime Minister, Gon Coulibaly. But now, we know Mr. Ouattara himself wants to extend his term in power in Ivory Coast.
So but isn't the constitution strict on two-term? Doesn't it have a two-term limit? And what led to the fallout between President Ouattara and Guillaume Soro?
No, I think President Ouattara changed the constitution. And then even with the new constitution, the experts said that he cannot run anymore. But Mr. Ouattara has a different understanding of the new constitution. And so that's the one point number one. Point number two, Soro, in the beginning, was Ouattara's right-hand person. And when he became Gbagbo's prime minister, there was some suspicion that Soro was leaning towards Gbagbo, even though we knew that Soro was going to betray Gbagbo the way he did. And then he switched back to Ouattara, and then he became Ouattara's prime minister. But like I said again, Ouattara had other plans, or he wanted to remain in power maybe forever, or he wanted to become president for maybe two more terms. And Soro also, he has been very imprudent. He was, it showed that he was not, he was in a hurry. And then he has shown to Mr. Ouattara that he wanted his seat. And then it's a power struggle.
Now, do you foresee a case where the arrest warrant could be squashed for the sake of peace? Because it has anticipated that if this continues, there could be insecurity in Ivory Coast.
Yeah, there was already insecurity. There has always been insecurity in Ivory Coast. We know it. Like I said, there was a rebellion for Ouattara to become the candidate when he was believed to have won the election. And then Gbagbo did not want to relinquish power because Gbagbo thought that he had won the election. Mr. Ouattara resorted to violence with the support of the international community to go and bomb Ivorians and to support the rebels. And when Mr. Ouattara became the effective president of the Ivory Coast, what did he do in 10 years? They were not respecting the people's freedoms, and then dissenting voices have been suppressed.
But
people have been put in prison, and people are still in exile, and those who have been freed cannot leave the country. So there was insecurity.
But this was denied by supporters of President Ouattara. They said some normalcy has returned. Ivorians go about their businesses without fear of being beaten or being arrested or being jailed. Mm-hmm. And that is why the seeming peace being enjoyed by Ivorians, people think President Ouattara should continue because peace and prosperity has returned to Ivory Coast. And that is why they want him to seek re-election. Why do you deny that?
I have one of my friends. She posted something on Facebook. It's a serious conversation, but I like what she said. That a mother told her that in the house, when you want to make sure that no one can steal anything that you have, then you give your wallet or your purse, you know, to the thief. So in the case of Ivory Coast, the one who brought violence is the one who is in power.
But Guillaume Soro was the leader of the rebellion, mm-hmm. not Ouattara, not President Ouattara. Before he became president, Guillaume Soro led the rebellion. And for the sake of peace, that led to the a form of government that ensured Guillaume Soro became the prime minister of then President Laurent Gbagbo. Isn't it the case?
No, I don't know, you know, how to discuss that. But the point is that those who won the war and who were believed to have won the election, they kept, you know, the power of the weapon. They had that, and then they repressed all dissent views in the country. This is the reality. That's point number one. And now, when people thought that there was a kind of peace in the country, we knew that those who fought to dislodge Gbagbo from power, sooner or later, they were going to fight because no one shares the presidential seat. So it is either Ouattara or Soro Guillaume. So that's the situation in which we find ourselves. And then yesterday, they were fighting for Alassane Ouattara's presidency. And now today, they are fighting for power. And then that's why people are concerned. Soro Guillaume was the leader of the rebellion. He has some warlords who recognized him as the leader, even though that rebellion was done on behalf of Mr. Alassane Ouattara. So it's an infighting.
But yes. Let me ask you, I understand Guillaume Soro still has a lot of support in the military. Mm. Do you foresee any possibility that he could be allowed to run for the presidency as an opposition leader?
This is what I'm saying. If people know Mr. Ouattara, I can tell you now, the answer is no.
Why?
Mr. Ouattara cannot govern in a democratic environment. He does not like dissenting views.
No, but that is not true. He won an election. That he was declared a winner.
Which one?
He won re-election.
Which one?
That is why he has two terms in office.
No, Peter, it's not happened like that. Even the election people said that he won. Even that election people said that he won. I have been saying for 10 years that I do not know who won the election because, according to some credible information, after the first round, Mr. Ouattara was number 3. That's another conversation.
Well, but that has not been proven. Let's move on.
Yes.
Now, going forward, people are expressing concern that if, for some reason, Guillaume Soro is not allowed to run, there could also be increased instability in Ivory Coast. What is your take?
I agree with you. I agree with people who say that. Because, again, if yesterday Soro Guillaume and Mr. Ouattara, they decided that they needed to use violence to impose the candidacy of Alassane Dramane Ouattara, today, what we know of Soro Guillaume, we can anticipate that he's going to resort to violence to try and impose his candidacy. Because Mr. Ouattara, there is no way Mr. Ouattara will allow him to run against him or to run against the one he may choose. Because we know Gbagbo is in Europe, in Belgium. Blaise Goudé is in the Netherlands, in Europe. And then Miss Simone Gbagbo, she's been freed, but she cannot move out. She cannot even travel out of the country. So Ouattara has created an environment in order to weaken his opponents or to silence those who can come and who can defy his regime.
But a lot of African leaders do that. You weaken your opposition in order for you to win re-election or win an election. But let me ask you this. If West African leaders or ECOWAS is able to broker a peace deal to ensure that at least Guillaume Soro is able to compete, who do you think will win in a fair, transparent, and peaceful election in Ivory Coast?
Or do you take into account the possibility...
Other opposition leaders?
No. Yes. Like to Gbagbo and then Ari Konabedie.
For now, we don't know if Gbagbo is able to do it or not because at the ICC, the ICC prosecutors are appealing the case. So he is at the moment.
So this is what I'm saying. So,
well, let's look at the current situation in Ivory Coast now.
Yeah, so there is a possibility that Soro can become a serious challenger, because people are fed up of Mr. Alassane Dramane Ouattara's system, and then I'm not saying that I'm not saying that Soro Guillaume is going to win the election, but I hear many people who do not like what he did, who think that they can go rally beyond any person who can stand against Alassane Dramane Ouattara. That's why Soro Guillaume feel emboldened to do what he's doing, and that's why Mr. Ouattara does not want any other person to run against him in the country. So
now let's look at former President Bédié. Mm-hmm. Do you anticipate him running? Because as at the moment, we heard reports, local reports, that he's not made up his mind yet, or he's going to support somebody else.
This is what I'm saying. He has already expressed the intention to run for president at age 85. And Alassane Dramane Ouattara may be, but then he will be like 78, and he still want to be the president of the country.
Well, if Ivorians decide to extend his term,
he's not Ivorian. You know how Alassane Ouattara became president through war. It's not what Ivorian wanted.
I understand that, but there has been an election, and he has won an election.
And even that election, this is what I'm saying, Peter. Even that election in 2015, how did he do it? Today as we speak, the international community, many of the representatives of the international community who supported him, today they do not like what he's doing regarding the Electoral Commission. He does not want to have to put into place like a transparent and then a transparent Electoral Commission. And then he wants to put his own people there to organize the election. So that's the same thing that he did in 2015.
But you can't blame him for that, because Ivorians would have to fight for a free, fair, transparent election. Hold on a second. Because in other countries where I have gone to cover elections for VOA, particularly political parties and supporters play a part in the transparency of the election. They are there when the votes are counted to protect their votes from being misapplied or undermined. Why can't Ivorians do the same thing?
There is a part of the opposition that Mr. Ouattara wants to deal with. People who do not have strong base. These are the people he wants to deal with. People who represent like Henri Konan-Bédié's party that was in the governing coalition. He does not even want to have negotiations. He doesn't want to have discussion with them. Same thing with Gbagbo's party. So then if you take some people who do not represent anything in the society, anything that they represent the opposition, then you are fooling or you are deceiving everyone.
But my question is, why are Ivorians not protecting their vote? If they said the elections were not free, fair, credible, and transparent, why are they not protecting their votes?
But do you think that people can protect their vote in a country where the leader is behaving like a tyrant or like a dictator?
Well, we can't say that.
I can't say that. Because these are the facts that we have.
Well,
I have already given you the example of Gbagbo. We know that the government
issue of Gbagbo doesn't come up.
No, it's important. Ouattara, when he saw that Gbagbo was going to be free, he sent his lawyers to ask the ICC to keep Gbagbo there.
Well,
this has been documented.
Well, let me put it this way. The ICC is appealing against the ruling by the judges absolving him of any crimes. So the process is not complete. So we can't go there because the case is still in court. But we'll continue with this discussion another time. Nyaka Lagoke is a political analyst. He joined me live from the VOA studios right here in Washington, D.C. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You're hearing from Yemi Alade with Lai Lai. Diamond Platinums featuring Omarion come next with African Beauty. Butera, No Less featuring Passy with Mbaye Wowi. Techno with Suru. And Posa Ya Bolingo ends with Alicious. I
chilling like OBO, but one day we gonna do it, do it, do it.
Israeli pambangonjera kutoka matanga sekera kwa vino vya paikopo kutoka manzambe picha twazi twanga kisera posti insta wanga kwa kera bada ya chali kimoko cause I just wanna let them know know my feet come you take.
Oh, yeah.
Zombie no dey baff. Come on. Zombie no dey zanku. They know the paper body you, paper body you, paper body. They know the paper body you, paper body you, paper body. Yes. Supposed to be tangled you, tangled you, tangled you. So you know be chukud you, chukud you, chukud. Kilo de, kilo de. Why you cry, oh mama? You won't call me suicide. You supposed to dance my cosa. I hate them, yo. What goes up, my skull? No kill yourself, no kill yourself. To go dance my blues, zulu lele, eh zulu lele, eh zulu lele, eh zulu lele, eh zulu lele. Oju eleba, oju eleba, oju eleba, oju eleba, oju eleba. Daddy body no dey bend, come on. Zombie no dey zang. They know the paper body, you, paper body, you, paper body. They know the paper body, you, paper body, you, paper body. Supposed to be tango di you, tango di you, tango di. So you know be chuku di you, chuku di you. Mama ileke, mama ileke, mama kule kwenye. Tell no la baja, tell no la baja. Anyway you know get, anyway you know get, do you know get. So you mustn't be by the ten. Oh, Kali Jen. So both that's my cost. Zulu, 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 Zulu,
music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Tiang Weng, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, do not say the first thing that comes to your mind. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
VOA News, I'm Gene Randall. Kazakhstan is observing a national day of